Mysterious Universe, Season 27, Episode 24. Coming up on this show, we've got The Nine Lives of Raymond Moody, Taiwan's Dream Doctor, and how dinosaurs are a scam invented by Big Museum. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
You can't start the show with Big Museum. Could you imagine someone tuning in that's never listened to the show before? I could just imagine the scenario. Someone's like, you need to check out Mysterious Universe. This is really great. These guys are really onto stuff. And then you're like, the dinosaur scam being run by Big Museum.
What if they came here because they heard about a scam run by Big Pharma and now I'm telling them about a scam run by Big Museum?
No, I believe it. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
And then other people are coming because they heard about a scam from Big Dog Food. There's a lot of scams being run by these big companies. And Big Museum is leading one of the biggest scams of all time.
You actually are suggesting that dinosaurs aren't real.
That's right.
Just with such a deadpan face.
Okay. Well, it was such a serious show last week. I want to mix it up a bit.
I know, it was very serious. And I'm doing the same for today's show because I thought last week it was really quite depressing. Like, if we're about to go through the collapse of society.
You did doppelganger something last week. What are you talking about?
Yeah, but when we were talking about the collapse of society, that was enough to just leave me a little bit like, oh, we need to lighten the mood. Like, we really need to lighten the mood. So what we're going to do for today's show is I actually want to continue what we were talking about on the Plus show this week, where I covered Ouija, The Most Dangerous Game by Stoker Hunt. And he, not in great detail, but he started crossing into some of these theories as to why people have the experiences with the Ouija boards in the way that they do. And obviously, I guess the main kind of idea is from the negative perspective is that, well, utilizing an Ouija board or, you know, similar methodologies like automatic writing, for example, or possibly channeling, leaves you open to low-level spirits, entities that can get through your aura and invade you. But what if it's actually coming from within you? And we're going to go into the more psychology, abnormal psychology side of things of that today. And I got inspired of looking into that by the work of Barbara Honegger. Barbara Honegger was a woman that was describing the idea that when we look at the left and right brain, that a second ego may be generated somewhere inside the brain. And occasionally that ego will manifest. And the way that that ego will manifest is through things like controlling your muscles, your fine muscle movements.
Yeah, you discovered this on the end of the last Plus show. You were quite excited when you found it. But isn't the research from the 1920s, 1930s?
No,
is it digestible?
No, so Barbara's stuff is relatively recent. But she, I didn't actually explain it correctly. So Barbara was just giving that idea about the psychology of it. But what she's actually, basically, she's following on from the work of Dr. Anita Mull. Dr. Anita Mull was doing this stuff back in the 1920s. In fact, 1922, she was doing therapy and she started realizing that there was something going on with her patients that suggested that there was maybe an abstract way of treating them. And the way that she came about treating them was through the use of automatic writing.
Oh, that's right. She would get them to just sit there with a pen in their hand, a piece of paper.
And then just let them write. And they would. They would write these flowery stories, some of which I'm going to go into on today's show. They would describe horrific disasters. They would describe, you know, terrible things that had happened in their life. And she was convinced that it wasn't a result of a possessing spirit coming through. It was actually a result of some type of psychological process going on inside each and every one of us. We all have the potential for these things to appear. It's kind of like multiple personality disorder, but it's not multiple personalities. Okay. I mean, that might be a part of it, but that's not really what it is. It's something else. It's some other mechanism, which unfortunately hasn't really been examined in modern psychology. It's dismissed. It's not possible. But when you look at some of her stories, it really makes you wonder. So we'll get into that in a moment, but what have you got coming up, obviously, apart from Big Museum?
No, that's all I've got.
Just Big Museum. Okay, great.
There's a new work by Eric Lyons and Carl Butt called The Dinosaur Delusion, and that's what I was hoping it would be when I went into it. I wanted to hear why dinosaurs are a scam, why they never existed, because these guys are creationists. They're Christian creationists, and I know that some Christian creationists actually believe that. They think that dinosaurs don't exist. It's some kind of hoax.
I knew of a guy that was, he was a reborn or what's it called? A born again.
Yeah.
And he was telling me all these stories about the earth being only 6,000 years old and how Noah was trying to push dinosaurs onto the ark. I'm like, okay, cool, dude. Like, well, that's what you believe. That's fine.
These guys have a more nuanced argument. The main thrust of their argument is that there were still dinosaurs around relatively recently.
And what's relatively recently? We're talking like 10,000 years?
15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Which would go a long way to explain some of the historical anomalies they believe are evidence for their claims.
Oh, okay.
Like certain carvings on temple walls that depict dinosaurs, or ancient artworks that are perfect representation of an Apatosaurus, for example.
I might have an answer for that coming up in this section
really?
Of the show. It might have something to do with what is considered by Moule to be the zone 3 of consciousness, or genetic memories.
Right.
So we'll go into that.
Have you seen the dinosaur documentary that's on Apple TV, and it's narrated by, what's his name? Gosh, blank, 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 blank. Attenborough.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And
no, I haven't seen it.
It's a beautifully animated series, and it's basically presented like a David Attenborough documentary, but he's narrating CGI dinosaurs.
Cool.
And it's really fun to watch. But you find yourself watching it going, really? Like, there's a certain point they've got the Quetzalcoatl giant, like the biggest flying creature ever in the history of the planet. Like, the thing is...
What is it? Is it a pteranodon or some type of...
Yeah, it's like a giant pterodactyl style. It's right. A flying reptile. It's absolutely huge. It's like three bus lengths across and a bus in height. It's just absurd. And you watch this thing on the screen and your mind's just going, no. Like, you have this visual, it's like an uncanny valley style effect where you're looking at it going, this thing can't exist because it just looks so wrong. Everything about it is wrong. And there's no way it could get off the ground. Like, its head is so big. How do the aerodynamics even work? Like, what's the engineering behind it, the way it flies?
And that's when you start crossing into those ideas, like the idea that gravity was lower, you know, 300 million years ago.
Yeah, so I might touch on that later on in the show, but it's funny because watching that show, you hear David Attenborough narrating some of the ways that they've gotten around these engineering problems of giant dinosaurs that shouldn't be able to fly.
Okay.
You hear him say, well, their bones were made of pieces of tiny spaghetti, and it was so light it was like a paper flying through the air. Like, it's just, they come up with complete nonsense. Like, their bones were just hollow, and they were the lightest creatures ever on the face of the earth. It's like, what are you talking about? You're just coming up with this nonsense so that we can believe that this giant monstrosity that shouldn't exist could actually fly. And this is one of the major criticisms against the well, not the existence of dinosaurs, but it's like...
Our understanding of them.
It's a paleontological problem. It's a conundrum that dinosaurs were so big, especially the flying dinosaurs.
But we do have, obviously, fossilised remains of them.
Yeah, we know they existed.
So we know that they have that size.
But it's a conundrum. There's a conundrum.
Mm.
So it's like dinosaurs, the very large ones, it was initially thought that they existed in water because that's the only way that their weight could have withstood, you know, the atmosphere. There's no way that a being could be that big and be land-based. They must have been water, like supported by water. So like a huge Diplodocus, for example, was always in water.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually that was proven to be not true because of the way that their feet worked, the way that their paws worked. So that, again, left a conundrum. They're so big, how did they even hold up their own weight? It does, like, the engineering doesn't make sense. So I'm going to get to that in the end of the show and then explain why Dinosaur is a big hoax by Big Museum.
Great, I'm looking forward to that. I always find with those documentaries, particularly about anything that's prehistoric, that they know how they behaved. And I always go, how? How did you know that Diplodocus did some mating ritual dance?
Yeah.
How? And they go, oh, well, we based it on reviewing modern Diplodocus relatives such as this bird. I'm like, what?
They need to do the Stanislav Grof method where they just give paleontologists a shitload of LSD and send them into the consciousness of an ancient dinosaur.
It's funny that you should mention LSD there because there's this idea in Japan. It's called ignoring unto death, right? And it's basically that when you engage in any type of divination, communication with spirits or something like that, is that you never engage directly with it. And this is something that Mule found out in her research. So when Mule got these patients that were coming through, most of the time they were people that had been hospitalized. And obviously, psychology standards are very different back in the 1920s as to what they are today. But these people were normally quite in a bad state, like they've gotten themselves to a bad state. And obviously it's not with every patient, but she did start to find these trends that were reoccurring of where they seemingly might have engaged with something. You know, they may have engaged with an Ouija board, or they may have gotten into seances. Obviously in the 1920s, it was very popular for the time. And then all of a sudden it reignited something. It created some type of, it brought something up from this deep subconscious. And so with this idea of ignore unto death, it's like, yeah, go and do these things, but don't engage with it directly. Because if you do, you get consumed by it.
How can you do those things without engaging with it directly? Like, so, how do you use a Ouija board without engaging with it directly?
Basically, it's implementing a few strategies. Like if you're going to do something like that, only do it for a session, which is 20 minutes. Like do 20 minutes and don't do it every day. But if you start finding that it's creeping and you're becoming obsessed with it, that is you actually engaging directly with it. If you find that you have the same entity coming through over and over again, there could be, and it's giving you information, right? Things that you're not supposed to know and yet somehow you do. That could start being an indicator that you're getting pulled in by this thing. But essentially with Mule, she thinks that, no, this is coming from within you. It's already inside your mind. And she describes these three zones of consciousness. One is the first zone that we all exist in our general ego and our day-to-day activity. We're conscious of it. We know what we're doing. You can do things like you can dream, daydream, and you have obviously, imagination. That's all possible, but you're always in this conscious, knowing state. Then you have the next layer, which is zone two. And zone two is the area where most of her research will come from. This is the zone of the unconscious mind, but there's multiple layers. It's like, speaking of paleontology, there are all these layers of the unconscious mind that you can dig through. And depending on which one you can pull up different pieces of information and get insight into your patient and what they're suffering. But the reality is it's very difficult to penetrate deep layers. Like there's just some patients that no matter what you do, you can't get through to them. You can't get the information out. You can never understand why they have a particular phobia or why they have a certain, why they're egotistical or why they've got a certain personality trait. Until, of course, you use alternative methods. And the alternative method that she used appears to be something very simple, but something highly unorthodox, even by modern standards. This was the utilization of automatic writing. And where I say that she never actually engaged, got her patients to engage directly, is that she took a handkerchief and essentially established this little apparatus that she'd built. She'd built a clamp and she put the clamp on the table, bolted it to the table, and then hung this handkerchief from it and got the patient to put their hand in through the handkerchief. And then she put a pencil or a pen in their hand. At the same time, she would then go get a newspaper or a book or some type of material. She would hand it to the patient and she would say, please read me this chapter. And the patient would have to read aloud. So you're focusing. And of course, when you are reading aloud, it is a difficult thing to focus on anything else. You do go into the space. This is why you read aloud. But she did this with a very specific reason. She wanted the hand to not be conscious of what was going on, because this is where you allow it to come through. And I would be fascinated to know what would happen to her if she had utilized drugs in her research as well. Because one warning that was put forward by Stoker Hunt, and of course I'll link to this book in the show notes, Ouija, The Most Dangerous Game, and also have a listen to the previous Plus episode, which I'll link to as well. He warns, right? It's not just, youngsters and teenagers and, you've got to be careful of these things. He's like, never, ever, ever use an Ouija board when you're drunk or on drugs of any kind. Don't engage in that. Don't engage in automatic writing. Don't engage in channeling. And he's approaching this more from the perspective of, well, you're, reducing your resistance to these entities that are hanging around, that are all wanting to jump through. From Mule's perspective, it was almost like it took so much effort to allow the zone two consciousness to come through. But you're probably sitting there going, well, what's this zone two consciousness? Like, where is this coming from? If it's not external, like if we're talking about automatic writing and Ouija boards and channeling, if it's not coming externally from spirit possession or things, low energy entities trying to get through, where's it coming from? It comes from psychological trauma. It comes from early childhood experiences that explode later in life.
She thinks they've been compartmentalized.
They completely get compartmentalized. They get completely shut down, broken down, compressed, and pushed into the second zone. And depending on how much pressure they have, and whether it's from people suffering issues with, their family or a trauma that takes place, they don't come out. Of course, until then, something happens later in life. And so with some of her patients, she would have patients that have been admitted for psychiatric issues. And oddly enough, where this fits with other stories we hear, right, like the mind is such a powerful thing. These people that were experiencing these issues also had physical symptoms as a result of what they thought was voices.
Well, the idea almost aligns perfectly with the shamans we've been talking about recently. Remember I mentioned the guy who got so terrified in a shark attack scenario that part of his soul splintered off and he was basically comatose. And the treatment from the shaman was to go and retrieve his soul because the trauma had created this. I mean, this was the language he used, a splintering of his soul. It was literally somewhere else. He had to reintegrate it with his body. You're talking about the same thing.
It's a perfect example. You're right. It's Western psychology basically giving a description of this, you know, traditional medicine idea of approaching this. And it is true. It's like there's this splintering. It's a creation of a personality which sits and essentially festers. Like and sometimes if it's a negative thing, it festers in this second zone, but it could create a whole world of problems. I mean, I'll give you one example, right? So there was this story that was actually investigated by Ed and Lorraine Warren, the demon hunters, the demonologists, you know, and we've covered some of their stories in the past, you know, they did incredible work. Well, they got this letter from this woman, right? And this woman was like, please, please help me. I need help. I'm just suffering these terrible things. Now, Ed and Lorraine Warren went down the path that this poor woman was being attacked continuously by a succubus, like some type of entity. But in light of Mule's research, it might be something different. It might be something internal. So for her, right, she writes this letter. And she says to them, look, I really need help. No one else can help me. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to go, but I'll try to be as coherent and logical as I can be. For most of my life, I've been a card reader. I've been a psychic all my life, but I've only recently gotten into card reading. And when I got into card reading, she was devastated, right, that her mother had passed away. So she left the cards and engaged in other practices. And it doesn't say exactly what the practice was, but we can assume it's probably, you know, Ouija board. And she started trying to get in contact with her mother. And funnily enough, her mother starts coming through, right? So she starts communicating. And this entity that's coming through on the board knows everything that her mother would, right? Or that she would know about her mother. Like all these details start flowing through. And she was like, at first, you know, it was very calm and it was very kind and polite. But then I realized that this wasn't my mother, right? And as soon as she changed her attitude, I was like, hang on, this isn't my mother. This thing got angry. Like it got really, really angry. It started, she claims, and this is why she contacted Ed and Lorraine Warren, is that it started attacking her physically. Like she was being physically attacked. She would have bruises. She developed this pain in her pelvis. She had a bladder infection that came about. She ultimately goes so far as to claim that she was being sexually assaulted by this thing. But there's never any evidence of that. Like she was just claiming this. But she said that she would be in bed at night and she would wake up to find the thing hovering over her and whispering and attacking her. But she wouldn't scream out because she didn't want to scare her children. I think her experiences, though, what she's describing is very genuine. But I don't think she's necessarily suffering from the demonic possession or some type of attack, which is the way that the Warrens went on this one. In light of Mule's work, it's possible that two things happened. First of all, she was suffering from the trauma of losing her mother, right? And so she had this wanting to get in contact with her mother. Possibly something has happened in her childhood, some type of trauma, some type of experience, which settled itself in zone two. And it created this consciousness, it created this personality splintering that sat in zone two and it could never get out. And this is really important with Mule's work as well. These things, they want to get out. So whatever they're created from, whether it's from an accident as a child, some trauma that you suffer, there's also a little bit of cryptonesia that takes place as well. It's like you can create these falsified kind of memories, and I'll go into that in a moment. But they all kind of, in a tulpa-like fashion, create this thing that sits in your mind. And for the most part, we're fine. For most of us, we're okay. Until something happens that triggers that release.
So it's a sentient entity. Created from trauma and resides in you. But it is not the controller of your body. It doesn't control you in any way. It's just sitting there waiting.
Sitting there.
So what is the situation? What's the scenario that allows it to have influence?
You need to be weakened. And the way that you can be weakened is through things like drug use. And it's funny that we talk about, you know, spirit possession seemingly affecting people that are drug abusers, alcoholics, those sorts of things. It could come through from grieving. So a lot of the time that this happens, it's like something's, you know, taken place. It can also happen in cases of where there's a disconnect to reality. Like if someone has a sudden change in their life, that sudden change can be jarring enough that it allows this thing to burst through.
And so when she has her patients doing the automatic writing, is the idea that their main consciousness becomes, I
distracted.
Guess, distracted enough
yes.
that this festering sentience
yep.
can now communicate that's, through the hand.
That's right.
Through the automatic writing.
And sometimes, like, it can just be very simple.
It's
but
like, let me out!
Yeah, well,
let
they are.
Me out!
But some of them are angry.
Really?
Some of them are angry that they've been ignored for so long. You know, there was a crazy thing that this is a really big warning as well, because we've heard stories over the past about, you know, the idea of imaginary friends and that kind of stuff. Well, with imaginary friends, for most children, they disappear. You know, they're ephemeral. They're gone. For some people, though, if you discourage your child and say that's nonsense and start, you know, giving a child a hard time, that imaginary friend can actually lodge in zone two. And what will happen is years later, people's imaginary friends, when they're suffering from stress or have an issue, that imaginary friend reappears.
Oh, my God.
And starts. And this is the thing. It messes with your life.
Why is it that the parents telling the child the imaginary friend doesn't exist? Why does that lodge the imaginary friend in zone two?
Because basically it's like there's a whole heap of psychological factors that are going on here, but you've got things like shame, you've got things like ignorance, you are basically a child, you know, wants to be encouraged, a child, and if you are, you know, dismissive of it and laugh at the child and embarrass the child, all those things, all those emotions and factors play a role in cementing this thing into the zone two of the consciousness.
So it's again like a splintering effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, because of this ridicule that comes through. So look, I mean, her
are you saying that Bubbles the monkey could still be lodged somewhere in my consciousness?
Yes. Waiting to come through after a trauma or something. Actually, I mean, you pointed me today in the direction of a book about delusions, and I ended up not going into it in great detail because it was very, it was the way that it was written. Oh, it was just so.
It started off really cool because she was writing about, what was it, the King Charles VI, France. Who believed that he was made of glass, and he was constantly terrified that when he sat down, because his ass was made of glass, his ass would shatter. So he would be constantly reinforcing his buttocks with pillows and blankets.
No, he went so far as apparently he sewed metal rods into his clothing to make sure that he would never break.
Yeah.
He also, you're right, he was so convinced that his ass was glass that he wouldn't sit on anything hard. He wouldn't allow himself to be touched because he thought that he would break like a pane of glass.
And this was during the 100-year war as well. So he just would have been running this incredible campaign of constant warfare.
Yeah.
And then he'd get home and he'd be like, oh, if only I wasn't made of glass, this would be so much easier.
But this was a delusion which actually fits in with Mill's research, because essentially the reason why this happened to him, right, it seems like it's something so absurd. How could you believe that your backside is glass or that you've turned into glass? Well, what happened to him is that he had a jarring technological moment. So just before he started having these delusions, there was the creation of Crown Glass. And Crown Glass was, I mean, we see glass today and we're just like, pfft. Glass, like who cares? But for them, this was like an alchemical technology that was being developed. You could transmute sand into this like semi-physical, like liquid, solid thing that was glass. And it was so shocking to some people that it actually integrated into their psyche and made people believe that their bones would turn into glass through the same alchemical processes. And that seemingly is what happened with this King Charles. You know, I'm surprised. I mean, I wonder if there's research out there that shows that something else came through and had other experiences. But these delusions fit in perfectly with Mule's research, because she had a whole heap of people, obviously, that are in psychiatric facilities that are suffering from wild delusions. But it wasn't always bad, right? So she ultimately was knowledgeable about the Society for Psychical Research, and she understood, you know, the whole idea about automatic writing and channeling and this information coming through from somewhere. And she started seeing parallels in her own work. So in 1922, she decided that she was going to set out to do her own experiments. And she ended up getting involved with 150 cases of people trying to work out, you know, what is it with this zone two consciousness? And she started seeing things, right, that was occurring in psychologically stable and normal people. So she went to this conference, and when she went to the conference, there was pieces of paper that were left around, right? And she put all these pieces of paper around and she left pens. And then later on, after this lecture had finished, she went and picked up these pieces of paper, trying to look at the doodles, right? Obviously not very scientific, but trying to understand what was. And when she looked at the doodles, everyone had drawn the same kind of things. They were all like gardens, fields, pots, flowers, trees. Why would they all doodle the same kind of thing? And none of that was part of the presentation. Like no one was talking about trees or pots or flowers. And yet these people started describing the same thing. So could this be some type of collective subconscious kind of thing? Obviously, this was, you know, fascinating to her and inspired her to go even deeper with this. And that's where she just touches on the idea of zone three. And zone three is the genetic unconscious. This is where you've got repressed long-term memories that sometimes form things like cryptonesia. Cryptonesia is where, you know, it's like, it's not that it's imaginary, but somehow it's wiped from your memory. It's like something that actually happened to you, but it's wiped from your memory and it can come up in spontaneous ways. Well, with her, she was saying in this zone three, maybe that's an explanation for a lot of this stuff. Like people are actually pulling information through from past, not their past lives, but the past lives of their family members. And that information is contained within their DNA. It's genetically in there. And I'll go into that in greater detail in a moment. But before we do that, let's talk about some of these secondary personalities. And, you know, she pointed out actually what was really strange is it was some of these secondary personalities. So she'd gotten into the research and she'd had patients start coming in and they were doing automatic writing. And some of the stories that were coming out, some of them were very waffly. Some of them were very like describing, oddly enough, like stories of fairies. And in the book, and this is a very old book, but she actually goes through and she posts the writings of some of her patients. And they do, they just describe, like there's one chapter that just, this patient essentially spends pages and pages and pages while distracted, writing in automatic writing about the color of the fairy's wings. Like it's this weird thing, right? It's completely pointless.
And does the patient have any knowledge
they
of what they're writing?
No knowledge of what they're writing, right? Down to the point, right, that she says, and this is where it starts crossing into the idea of spirit possession, but there is a reason for this. People will write, for example, they'll have deceased family members come through. Mm. And these deceased family members come through, their handwriting is identical. Like it's the handwriting of their deceased family member, yeah. Right? And you go, oh my God, that's incredible. That's an example of obviously the spirit coming through and being able to survive death. She's like, no, that's not what's going on at all. These secondary personalities, not only do they sit in the zone two and fester, they also watch everything from the beginning. And she suggests that they even take their time to make an exact reproduction of a deceased person's handwriting. So they will, because you do, you spend your life, right? And you will see your mother's handwriting, it will happen. You'll see family members' handwriting. The secondary personality, it learns it and it hangs on to it. And later on when it comes out, it's like, oh, it's the mother. Oh, it's my deceased father.
They're deceivers.
She says it's even crazier than that, right? Sometimes when she's had this writing happen and they've been writing these stories out, she'll take the piece of paper and she says, not only is it written backwards, it's written upside down.
Huh?
Like these personalities are coming through. It's backwards, like it's written backwards and upside down. Now, I could not do that.
Yeah, that's something that would be really difficult, to do.
There is absolutely, even with practice, I don't think that I could just sit there reading a newspaper and have my hand written that way. Another great example actually is, and I've got this here for you, I took it directly from the text to read it to you. This is the story of Violet Zed, right? So Violet Zed was suffering from, you know, multiple psychological issues and disturbances, and she had a number of problems. But she had multiple sessions. Now, with Mule, the reason why she was approaching this was not only to understand the psychology of what was occurring with people, but also, like, she had kind of this altruistic approach of trying to reduce the amount of time that therapy was required. So rather than having years and years of therapy, you're trying to dig through and try and understand what the problem is, she could reduce it to 6 to 8 sessions. You know, of only an hour or so.
Really?
And, you know, because it was this subconscious, you know, type two thing that was coming through, it's almost a little bit like, it's like a release. It's not, I was going to say spiritual release, but it's not a spiritual release because ultimately it's still you, but it's a psychological release. It's a catharsis that allows these things to be released so that it's repressed. I mean, it sounds a little bit Freudian, but it's not Freudian by any means at all. She's not going into that. But she says with Violet Z, right? Violet Z ended up having, she became so sophisticated in only a few sessions at automatic writing that she would have her hand on either side of the table with a piece of paper on each side, and she would just be writing and writing and writing. One entity that was coming through on the left, so you can have multiple zone two entities, was a female, one was male. And the two of them were like coming through, and they ultimately end up having an argument on the paper. And Mule looks over at this paper, and she can see, like, it's like the right hand had this bold, flourishing, pompous kind of style, but they were struggling for supremacy. These two sides were going back and forth, and the left hand wrote, "If you'll help me, I can write better." And the right hand was saying, "No, I am stronger and I will hinder." And this, it became a graphic duel, is the way that she described it, with the right hand finally saying, "I am going to be strong," and taking over, and the left hand kind of giving up. But where it finally ended was that when the left hand was like, "Oh, okay, yeah, I want to be strong, but I'm weak," the right hand started writing, "Good, good, good," but in bigger and bigger letters.
Wow.
Like bigger and bigger. And so there was some type of dual conflict inside that was going on inside this girl, Violet.
And so this Violet woman, was she aware of these personalities?
No idea.
Outside of this session?
No idea.
So it's not like she's hearing voices.
No voices.
It's not like dissociative identity disorder where they're taking control of her body at certain points. It's
some
nothing like that?
I don't know particularly with her case, but some of that does come up. And this is why some of these people are obviously patients of Mule, because they have been suffering from dissociative episodes. Okay. Where something else comes through.
And so is Mule's goal to, like DID, to reintegrate those personalities into her main consciousness?
Yeah, well, it's not even so much to reintegrate, it's to release it. It seems like with most of the cases that once this ego comes through, once this second identity comes through, and it's basically allowed to get out what it wants to get out, she can apply the therapy tactic or whatever therapy is required to that entity. So you're not treating your patient, you're treating the secondary and their psychological problems. Once you heal them, well, then there's no flow-on effect to the primary patient, and the primary patient does recover. And there were plenty of examples of this where...
It still just sounds like spirit possession and releasing the attached entity.
Very much so. It's got an Edith Fiore kind of, you know, feel to this. But she was convinced that this was not external. Look, I don't... Obviously, because I'm happy to discuss her work, I find this, you know, truly fascinating. I'm not completely convinced that it's not external. I think there are low-level, and we've seen enough stories of this to know that there seem to be low-level entities out there that when you leave yourself vulnerable, that these things can come through. But she has found some cases in her research, and as I pointed out, you know, she looked at over 150 stories that suggest to her that there is some type of layering of the mind that allows these things to get in there and then come out later on. So one of the earliest cases, like she was talking to this 50-year-old English woman. She married at 24 years of age. She had a daughter that she admitted that she didn't like. Her husband died, so until age 33, she was working as a housekeeper. Very stressful, you know, very difficult time for her. And in the 1920s, of course, you know, she got involved in the seance movement. She started using Ouija boards. While using a board one day, she claimed that she had this queer electrical zapping, is the way it was described. Like it came from the board and through her and was flowing through her. Now, very quickly, she felt that she was being controlled by the spirit of her dead father. And she was being thrown about. Like there was actual forces that were throwing her to the floor, although no one actually saw them, right? But she was being thrown to the floor. There seems to be a little bit, though, of hysteria going on as well, because she started doing things like, oddly enough, it seemed to whatever was occurring to her that this entity, which I think was like a secondary entity, was masquerading as her father. But she started developing telepathic powers. Like she herself, after having this experience, started developing her own abilities, which she was touring around and lecturing. But then she was doing stupid things like whenever there were like groups of men around, she'd I'd fall to the ground, hoping that men would pick her up. And they would, right?
That's but then so there was, hot.
But there's this one scene where she's like, and she fell down and all these men were just like, all right. They just ignored her. She's like...
That's not a helpful way like, to catch a husband.
She's like, it just gets up, right? So it's like, well, is it because the entity is doing that or the secondary, you know, intelligence or why? You know, why is that going on? But with her developing powers and her mediumship powers, she ultimately ended up being obviously under the care of Mule, and Mule put her through all this automatic writing. And by putting her through this automatic writing, she was able to release her from the control of these spirits. And it was quite detrimental to her, though, because this woman, this 50-year-old woman throughout her life had had terrible health problems, like always had these terrible health problems, again, seemingly linking in with whatever's going on psychologically, like that long-term, you know, trauma of these illnesses does change your perspective of the world. So, but whenever she became possessed, she was healthy. She had actual physical, so whatever physical traits she had that she was ill with, she recovered from them when she was, but it was.
So again, this is a little bit like multiple personalities.
It's like multiple personalities.
Where the physical attributes of the dissociative personality are taken on.
Yeah. And then though, when she was later on, she would do things like channel, right? And she was doing mediumship and she was saying just crazy, and like she was allowing things to come through. Because she was, you know, locked in a psych ward, they're able to monitor her. Whenever these things happened, her larynx and her tonsils became inflamed, like heavily inflamed. But unlike an infection, it wasn't like, because it would end. As soon as the channeling ended, so did the infection. So it's like, well, is it the power of the human mind? Can the mind do this? Can this hidden subconscious personality that comes through, can it just so strongly affect you? I mean, people like Dolores Cannon believe that. Like Dolores Cannon has pointed out in her research that everything that happens to the human body, I saw a clip from her a while back where she was saying that all human disease is basically the body trying to talk to you, and that it has the ability, you can heal it by listening to it. And that kind of ties in with Mule's work in a bit of a way. It's like this secondary ego, these intelligences, these zone two personalities, they're trying to get through to you, and sometimes they can manifest in these ways. They can manifest as illness, or they can manifest as health, allowing these things to come through. But then there was Lily, right? And Lily was this great example of where, like, she was the one describing the fairies and, like, all these pages and pages and pages of the color of the wings. Like, it was kind of ridiculous. But she started describing an entity that was coming through called My Dearest. And she ends up, Lily, going to having therapy sessions. And while she's having therapy sessions, Mule asks, well, who's My Dearest? Like, what's My Dearest? My Dearest ends up being a yellow fairy. Right? It's this yellow fairy that's always been around with her. The fairy came about after her mother died when she was young.
Again, the trauma.
Her mother died when she was young. She created this imaginary friend of these fairies. This yellow fairy then actually embedded inside her head, inside her mind, as this thing, and it hadn't come up until she had trauma later on in life.
Wow.
And but what the outlier is about that story as well is that then she had all this vivid recall. This is a strange thing. I mean, I know that people have vivid imaginations, but she was describing this place in her backyard where she would go. And she would go into the realm of these fairies. And she was able to describe, and it was coming through, and she wasn't describing. I shouldn't say that. Like, she was automatically writing it.
I mean, that's the thing with thoughts and imaginations, though. They don't dissipate into nothing, because thought is a material existence.
In another reality.
In another reality, it's physically there. Like, you can go back to the theosophists, the early theosophists, Ledbetter and Besant, where they were writing about sitting in church and with their psychic abilities, seeing the thoughts emanating above the members of the congregation.
Yeah, right.
And some guy's thinking about the new automobile he wants to buy, and they can see this shape forming above him that kind of looks like a car. And someone else is imagining a dress that she wants to buy, and someone else is jealous of their neighbor, and there's all these weird shapes. And we can't see them, but some people can, and they're real physical. They have a real physical existence. So a young girl who goes through the trauma of losing a parent and focuses all her intense mental energy on the idea of this protective
fairy, yep,
doesn't dissipate into nothing. It creates,
yep,
a sentient entity.
Yep.
It's a real life,
yep,
that is created from our thought. And if it gets enough energy, it has agency.
Well,
it has its own,
yeah,
kind of effect on the world.
And it sits in your subconscious somehow. There's some psychological mechanism that we don't understand that allows this thing to exist.
Yeah, it just doesn't have a physical body.
Yeah. It's bizarre stuff. Then, of course, we have the case of Tookie. Now, Tookie was quite intriguing. So this was this 23-year-old woman She was an invalid, so obviously there's elements of trauma there, but she was an invalid and she had gone in to get a lot of therapy because she'd had a breakdown. There was obviously psychological issues that were occurring if she came under the care of Mule. But ultimately she goes in and the automatic writing starts. And little details though start coming out when she looks, when Mule looks at her psychiatric history. Like she gets these details coming through. And one was that at 4 years of age, all she wanted to be was an orphan. We don't ever find out why. It was just this weird thing. And I know that children love their parents. I mean, I know that children come up with crazy ideas, but she was obsessed with being an orphan, right? It came out of nowhere. When that ended, the next thing that she obsessed about is that she had this desire to be a twin. Like she wanted to be a twin. And out of this, it's not actually directly said, but she believed in it so much that some type of twin did form.
That's a weird obsession.
Isn't it weird?
Why
right?
do you want to be a twin? I guess you get to share outfits.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, kids come up with crazy things and maybe she'd seen it somewhere and she thought that was cool. And yeah, maybe you're right. Like wearing the same outfits, you know, who knows? Like, I reckon if I had a twin, I'd kill him. You know, it's just like,
yeah,
we'd be like Spy vs. Spy. We'd just be trying to kill each other all the time. But no, she had this life where, you know, this imaginary friend and kind of had been created as this twin. But when she started looking into the family history, it turns out that this woman, Elizabeth, she was quite a difficult child. She was aloof and she spoke to the family members and the sister. And it became to, like the sister described that apparently there was Tookie, right? Tookie was this thing, this imaginary friend, which seemingly was the twin, right? But we're not too sure about it. But Tookie was this imaginary friend that Elizabeth always described when she was a child.
It sounds like a Sasquatch name. Is it a giant hairy dude?
No, it's like a little girl. Oh. Like it's this little girl that hangs around. But Tookie was really, really naughty. Like she would do outlandish pranks and she would do all these things. But it wasn't Tookie doing it. Elizabeth was the one pulling these pranks. And the family was like, what's happened to this kid? Because there was a distinct change with her when she was young. It was around 5 years of age that there was this change. And she behaved terribly. Like she would, basically cause a huge amount of trouble. And she'd get into trouble. And when she did, the parents would say, what's wrong with you? She'd say, oh, no, Tookie did it. This went on for a long time until they would scold her. Like they scolded her and they ridiculed her and they made her and laughed at her. And it got to the point where she would do things like she would actually go and write stories of adventures that she had in the garden, listen, with fairies. Like these fairies were, like Tookie would take her to see fairies that were in the garden. And she would write these elaborate stories and she'd put them into books. Now she found the books years later that she'd hidden around the house and she started reading it and she's like, this isn't my handwriting. Like this isn't
what?
This isn't me. I didn't write these things. Like, she knows that she wrote them.
Tookie wrote it.
Well, yeah, it's like some entity. And all of this, like obviously life gets in the way, right? And all this kind of died down. And we're skipping forward into the future and she's in her 20s. And at 14, she has this automobile accident. And this automobile accident obviously causes a lot of injuries. This was the triggering for the return of Tookie. Because she started saying, like, from 14 till her early 20s, all these things were going on where she was waking up exhausted, like absolutely exhausted.
Really?
It's because she was going out at night.
What?
And running. The second, we don't know this, like it's not directly said.
Tookie was going out on the town.
Well, we find out later on that, yeah, the second entity seemingly had been able to take control of the body. Tookie was there. Guess what Tookie was? Tookie was the embodiment of the wish that she had as a child to have a twin.
What happens when you spend your mental energy on something, and it gets created.
What's even more bizarre is through the automatic writings, obviously Mule tries to pull out more information about this. She wants to try and directly speak with Tookie and understand what Tookie's saying. Tookie, like Elizabeth, she calls her Lisbeth. Like, it's like a little girl. Mm. But Tookie knows of Elizabeth. Elizabeth has no idea of Tookie. Like she'd forgotten about her.
Oh, wow.
Totally forgotten about that second ego was sitting there waiting to come through as a result of the accident. So the accident had kind of like psychologically traumatized her, damaged her, and allowed the second thing to finally break through from zone two into zone one without her knowledge. And it does have this feel of multiple personalities, but it's a little bit more complex than that because they can't just spring through. They need to have a gateway.
When I was a very young teenager, this is an embarrassing story, I was so obsessed with basketball. Like, I loved basketball. but I wasn't great at it. I was pretty good. Like, I was better than my friends, but I wasn't good enough to do anything with basketball. So I constantly used to think, oh, if only I'd been born a very tall, athletic black guy.
Please don't tell me you've got a tall, athletic black guy in your head.
There might be like some tall 6'8" point guard in my second zone somewhere waiting to come out. Like, what if I have a car accident? And then all of a sudden I start talking jive to you in the studio.
I think you're just a bit too old now to be that kind of basketball player. So I think that's not going to happen.
But your whole point of your story is that he never went away.
No, that's right.
He's still there somewhere.
Well, I think
he's just dribbling, like practicing his free throws, getting his three-pointers down. He's waiting to come out.
There's other factors. This is the difference, though, is that there's other factors. And normally with these patients is that there's been a trauma to embed it in the first place. So that's what's had to happen. So if you were going and telling people about, it's not enough, right, for you just to be obsessed with it, right? You had to create that ego. You had to create him and then interact with him.
Oh, so it's got to be more than
it's like an imaginary friend. It's like a, it's got to be more. It's got to be like you are actually, it's kind of toolpick, as I said, like you've got to be feeding it and creating it and morphing it like clay. And then you dismiss it, but you don't really dismiss it. And it needs to be cemented in there through a trauma. So all these people, like they're suffering, and they're kids, they're suffering traumas, they're losing family members, they're having accidents. There's a whole, you know, psychological mechanism in there that, you know, we just don't understand.
Okay, I should be fine then.
You should be fine. Although in saying that, right, so Dr. Raymond Moody, who I'm going to go into some of his research in a moment, he started looking at this, right, and he looked at not necessarily automatic writing, but he was looking at the information recall and the healing ability of, and because, you know, this stuff does cross into healing, he was looking at the healing ability of kind of going into previous lives and then working out, you know, why in this life do you constantly have a headache? And it was because you were attacked by something in a previous lifetime and addressing that. Well, he found that because, like, with psychological research, it's only ever focused on people that are already unwell. Like, you're bringing patients into hospitals. There was one of the first studies, obviously that's changed, but one of the first studies to look into, you know, what experiences people have from, you know, a generally healthy population. He found that there was a certain level of people that just had these experiences, that just walked around with them every single day. They just thought it was completely normal. And, you know, it's not necessarily a psychological condition. It's something which is part of being human, but some people deal with it better than others. And this is why when they don't deal with it well, they end up in psychiatric facilities and then come to the attention of people like Mule and Dr. Raymond Moody. But with Mule, you know, one thing she also found out, this is where it does start crossing back into spirit possession, is that Tookie explained that she was an imp. And that came out later on.
An imp?
An imp. So Elizabeth didn't appear to have any knowledge of what an imp was, right? I mean, obviously, colloquially, maybe she did, but she hadn't created an imp. She'd created a twin, like another one of her.
What is the traditional idea of an imp?
Well, an imp is like a playful little...
like a demon,
like,
right?
A demon, yeah. But playful and mischievous and like a gremlin-style kind of thing. But it explained that it was an imp. And it enjoyed, this is what it also expressed in the writing, it enjoyed getting Elizabeth into trouble and seeing her being punished.
Why would a tulpa call itself an imp?
Yeah, it's a bit strange, right? And the good thing about this story is, though, is ultimately, I don't know if this is the condition what it would be referred to as today, but Elizabeth was suffering from toxemia and obviously some type of physiological condition that was causing problems for her. After releasing this thing, the toxemia abated. So it's like, again, like, is this just simply what Mule was trying to address? Again, is it
because
that
I think at the end, the root of a lot of illnesses, there is an entity. A lot of major illnesses are from an entity.
Fascinatingly enough, could it be, though, that that entity is something that you might create yourself? Like, is this what's happening? Like, people, and maybe, like, we talk in psychology about self-fulfilling prophecies and sort of things like that, you know, and people basically sabotaging themselves. Maybe that could extend a little bit further into causing physical symptoms. And that seems to be the case. But somehow, you know, they're anthropomorphized. You know, somehow they're given a character, a personality that bursts through. But it's never really positive. Like, and maybe that's because of the state of the... Maybe there are, you know, symbiotic examples of this out there. But they never seem to be beneficial to these patients. They always seem to be parasitic, which then crosses back into spirit possession. It's like some type of parasite, but it's a psychological parasite. And I don't know. I mean, she's just obviously in these particular cases, and yes, this is a very old book. You know, we're talking about research, which is now 100 years old. But it's always kind of like got the same formula to it. It's like, oh, well, they do the automatic writing and then they address the entities and they heal what's going on and then they leave hospital and they're fine. Like, I don't know if that would be actually the case. Would that be the case in every single time? Are they able to remove people? And, you know, I'm not so sure. But let's cross over now into the idea of Zone 3. But before
we Is there a Zone 4?
No, there's not. Well, there could be. But as far as I'm aware, there's only zone 1, 2, and 3. But I did happen to go through Dr. Raymond Moody's book, Coming Back, A Psychiatrist Explores Past Life Journeys. And the reason why I picked this up, it was a reprint. I mean, this is a book from the 1980s, I think. It's maybe the early 90s. 1990 was when this book was published. It was reprinted or republished in 2016. But it starts going through Raymond Moody's experience with past life regressions and hypnosis. And for him, Moody points out that he started to have patients that were psychologically healthy but described puzzling episodes that seemingly transported them back to a place that was in another lifetime. Like they would be in a historical lifetime, and he wasn't exactly sure why. This is what piqued his interest in this stuff. He started working with a well-known hypnotist by the name of Diana Dellenholm. And Diana was kind of thrust into this industry as well, because what she started out doing was, yeah, hypnosis, but it was for people that, you know, wanted to stop smoking or they wanted to lose weight, yeah, or that sort of thing. And she all of a sudden, occasionally, not all the time, but she found patients that would spontaneously fall back into previous lifetimes. Like they'd be thrown back into previous lifetimes. And so Dr. Raymond Moody got in contact with her and she was like, well, you know, I'm beginning to see this with my patients. I've been seeing it for years and I think there's something to it, because like what we were talking about with Mule, because she, like someone had an issue, they couldn't quit smoking. She'd do these, like they would spontaneously go back into a past life regression and I don't know, they'd be smoked and, you know, or burnt or something. And she would clear that away. And then in doing so, like, oh, I don't need to smoke anymore. So it had this healing. It had a therapeutic kind of effect, which has an appeal for someone like Dr. Raymond Moody, who was trying to teach people or try to heal people that have psychiatric conditions. And Raymond Moody, though, was like, I'm intrigued as to what this is. Let's put me under a hypnotic regression and let's just see where it goes. And he does. And this is where we get the nine lives of Dr. Raymond Moody. And I'll link to the book in the show notes so you can read all of them. But he really does go through this, and it's only in 2 or 3 hours, but it's almost like time is compressed when he goes into these regressions, because it seems like, or maybe it's expanded, sorry, he's just spending so much time inside these nine regressions. Like he just jumps from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime as Diana is guiding him through. And the first thing is he kind of starts off as this proto-human. Like he's looking down from his first-person perspective.
Remember this, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a proto-human, and they're...
Grug, he's Grug.
Well, he's unable to, he's can't communicate correctly. He's like, yeah, he can't communicate. And he realizes he has an emotion or like a fear or something, because I think they were fighting over some type of flour, which might have been food. Yeah. And he's like,
Grug smash.
Yeah. And then he jumps into his next lifetime. And into his next lifetime, he finds himself in Africa at one point. He finds himself as a mammoth hunter and he'd bitten off more than he can chew. And they're all running after this massive mammoth. And he's actually thinking like he's in that life and he's going, why am I doing this? I've never ever hunted something this big. This is so stupid. This is crazy. Yeah. You know, and then that he jumps. But the best story comes about where, and this leads into another story we'll have in a moment, is that he finds himself in the Roman Empire. Like he finds himself in this time and it's very vivid. And this is what's, I know imagination plays or can play a very, you know, I guess can create a clouding effect in these, because it's like, well, am I really recalling this or am I
really getting finger banged by three Roman soldiers? Is this really happening right now?
They're not mole people, Ben. Okay. No, that wasn't happening. What was happening is that he sees himself with this orangey kind of beard and the clothing that he was wearing. He was clearly a slave of some kind, possibly a gladiator, but a very low rung of society. And he's attacked. Like he describes this visceral scene of him being attacked by a lion. He was thrown to the lions. And he even says that at the last moment, the lion clamps onto his head. And he's thinking, oh my God, my skull is just about to be crushed. And right before, fortunately, his skull goes, he comes out of the regression.
That's an awesome sound effect.
It's just the way that he describes it in the book, that's exactly what it sounded like. Ugh. It was just like, oh God. But he comes out of this and he's like, yes, this is a mystery to me, but there's something in this, like there's something that I can pull out of this and potentially use for therapy. So he tried to do this series of structured scientific regression analyses. Like he tried to work out what's happening. And oddly enough, he didn't find necessarily validation of past life memories, but he found some psychological mechanism that sits inside us, much like with Mule's work, that is suggesting that you can access whatever this stuff is, whether it really is a past life memory or if it's something that's created in your head, it has an effect on your current life or in your current health.
Yeah, as we've seen countless times with people that have past life
so many of them.
Memories, and then something gets dislodged and they're now fine.
Yeah. I mean, like, speaking of the example of, you know, having your skull crushed, there's a woman that came to him that was suffering from these terrible headaches. Like, she had these terrible headaches that just went on and on and on. And she was on huge amounts of morphine and painkillers, which obviously is not good long term. She was groggy all the time. It was affecting her life. And she was kind of at the end of her wits. And she said to Moody, well, I need to just, for fun, she said, just for fun, let's do a regression to see if we can find something. And she's spontaneously thrown back into this world where, I know it's always cliche, where did you think she ends up?
Ancient Egypt.
Yep, she's in ancient Egypt, right? She ends up in ancient Egypt. She's not a temple whore, is what I was assuming. Bam. Well, we don't know that. Maybe that was her day job. But she finds herself in the street as there's invaders coming through. And these invaders, and she's... And apparently, while she's there in the hypnotic regression, her heart's pounding and she's clearly distressed by what's taking place. And this marauder comes running through with this big club. And of course, what do you think is going to happen? He smashes her in the head with a club. And then she feels, and she dies. Right? But that
memory unlocked the headaches and now she's fine.
And she's fine. Well, it didn't necessarily completely abate them, but it did start to slow them down. And she was on far less medication as a result of having this. So you can see the psychological benefits of I shouldn't just say psychological, the physical benefits of what this kind of stuff can have. But, you know, Moody wanted to dig deeper. He's like, well, I need to find out more. He describes this great case, which kind of throws everything into disarray, though, at the same time. It's the story of Ted. And Ted starts wandering, he goes into a regression, and he's wandering through this rock dwelling, which he just instinctively knows, and he inherently knows, this is in southwestern United States, and there's this vivid detail he's describing of this round room he's inside, and he can see the clothing of his people, like it's like Native Americans, and he can see them, and he starts seeing the tools that they fashion for agriculture, and they're all ornate, and I mean, what I mean ornate is from the vision that he's seeing, like he's able to describe them in vivid detail, this vivid recall, and he's like in shock because this is an incredible scene for him, right? He's like, it doesn't have any healing effect. He just finds it and he's like, oh, that was really cool. That was an amazing regression. Maybe that was a past life. And he was going along thinking, oh, I've just had a past life memory. No, this is what is referred to by Moody as a trapped memory, much like what Mule was referring to, right? So just through coincidence, this odd coincidence, a few months later, he's back at his parents' home and he's digging through this box of old things and he finds these 8mm films. So there is some weird role of like fate and synchronicity playing a role here. But he goes and he puts on this 8mm tape. And when the tape's playing, it's him as a kid and this memory he just doesn't have of him walking through one of these settlements that they went to as a holiday when he was a kid.
Oh, weird.
This memory.
But he believed he was a Native American in his regression.
But what's weird about this is that he didn't see people. And yet in the regression... He had created, like he could see their clothing. He could see the tools. And what is odd is that they were the clothing and the tools that they used.
I mean, maybe he had a past life in this tribe.
Maybe.
And then due to, you know, karmic paths in his future, he went through the same area as a kid.
Maybe. I mean, the other possibility here is that there is some zone 3 genetic memory that's coming through. Like there's some type of genetic recall that... The idea ultimately is that every single experience that you have, every single memory that you have, it's not stored inside your brain. It's stored in your DNA. And that DNA, and it basically is inherited. You inherit those memories and they come through. And what's really odd is that because, you know, DNA recombines, well, when you get, you know, a zygote and you got this recombinant, it's actually recombinant memory. So you get a mixing of memories. So in that particular case, it's like he could have had the memory of, yeah, he was there when he was a child, but then also he's got genetic memory of what the people would have looked like and what items they would have used, and that's all kind of recombined. But then at the same time...
Is he Native American, though?
No, he's not. No, but he could have.
So why would he
could have ancestry from that. I don't know. It's just not said. It's just, you know, a theory. But Moody was convinced that this is a trapped memory. And this trapped memory, though, is still, you know, an odd phenomenon because it means that... you know, people that are having these past life regressions and they're finding out why they're suffering from arthritis or having high blood pressure, and all of a sudden they're clearing away the issue that they had in a previous lifetime, and it stops, you know, the illness that they're having. It also could come about from a trapped memory that they're unable to recall. And it was just lucky in this weird set of circumstances that he happened to go through this box of film and he found that. He was able to go back to Moody, because otherwise to Moody, it just would have been another story. Like, it just would have been another experience. Then, of course, you know, you've got Helen Wombach, and she did a study of 26 therapists, regression therapists, who had done over 18,000 regression sessions. And this is something that Moody, you know, went and pulled out her data and tried to understand. And there was this great example of Mary. Mary had a lifetime of asthma. Like, and for whatever reason, it was this horrible, horrible asthma that took place. And she couldn't even cook meals. It would come over her all of a sudden. So she goes and she has regression therapy. And when she has this past life regression, she finds herself walking through the streets of London and there's a fog, and she goes into her home, and just as she shuts the door's kicked in by a home invader. And this home invader strangles her, suffocates her. And she sees herself floating off from her body, and she's just like, why did this man do this to me? And she ends up in her new life. She brings with it the suffocation, and it manifests in this life as asthma. The incredible thing about this is it was one session. One session, her asthma disappeared.
Yeah, it's amazing.
All by bringing up that one memory. See, what would be much, would be far cooler with this stuff, and it's just so difficult, like it remains just so elusive, is that if she could find the time frame that this happened and possibly a newspaper report, you know, of a woman being attacked, you know, in her home. But unfortunately, that information isn't forthcoming. So you're left with asking the question, well, is this a result of it being some sort of weird, even false memory that they've created in their head, manifesting through? And again, these things, like I said, they want to come through, and they come through any way that they can. So sometimes they can come through by controlling your muscle movements. Other times they come through as illnesses. And then they all, of course, they could come through in even more extreme ways. There was one case that I was looking at today, which I couldn't find a source for, which was the idea of a poltergeist, right? The poltergeist was being generated by this secondary entity. Mm. It couldn't do anything in the body, but it could access the psychokinetic abilities of this person and then wreck up the place. So, and of course, you know, when you hear about poltergeist, poltergeist always seem to be associated with a prepubescent child,
yeah,
or a child going through puberty. So, and again, a traumatic time, obviously not the same idea as trauma, but it fits into that category. So maybe this is what's occurring. There was another great case as well that was just described as postnasal regression. And I'm only just doing this because I like the idea of that. There was a guy by the name of, I don't have his name here, but it was investigated by George Schumer. And he published this in the Journal of Regression Therapy.
Did you say postnasal regression?
Postnasal regression.
What the hell are you talking about?
So this guy, this patient, had years, decades of a terrible post-nasal drip.
Like, God, imagine putting up with that for decades.
Oh, he couldn't, and he sought out all this help, and it wasn't mold, and he moved, and it wasn't asthma, it wasn't allergies, he couldn't work out what it was, and it became so bad that ultimately he came to having a regression. Now, he has this regression, and he describes in vivid detail, he said he went from being in the regression chair to seeing this wooden platform kind of materialize below him. Like, he saw this as much more vivid than a typical type of regression where people kind of get images coming through. He's like, I'm suddenly standing on this platform, and this platform kind of moves up like it's an object being materialized, and it's a vat. It's like a wine vat. And he's standing in this wine vat, and he somehow knows that he's in Spain in the 17th century. And he's like working away in this wine vat, you know, smashing all these grapes, and he sees his beloved over in the distance. She's mowed down by a horse and carriage.
Oh my gosh.
She's mowed down. He runs, like he jumps out of this vat, and he goes running towards her, and he holds on to her just as her, like he describes seeing her spirit leave her body. So I don't know if that's part of the past life regression, or somehow if he was psychic in that life, or it's just because he's in that space that he's capable of seeing it. But he says the spirit leaves, and in that lifetime, he starts to cry, but he's like, oh, men don't cry. So he represses it, right? He represses the whole thing. And he's like, I'm not going to cry. I'm not going to cry. And he crunches it up inside him and makes it this little ball, which then follows him from lifetime to lifetime as a post-nasal drip because he couldn't cry.
That's crazy.
And so ultimately, when, again, he has this understanding of this and it clears it, yeah, guess what happens within weeks? The post-nasal drip's gone.
I love those stories of some kind of karmic issue in a past life being traced through generations to the current one. I remember covering, I can't remember the researcher, but it was a similar situation where he had past life regressions with clients. And one guy, he had an issue with a muscular pain or something, and they eventually traced it back to a rival Mongol warrior who had killed him in a past, like he had killed this warrior in a past life, and this Mongol warrior, this chieftain, had kept a grudge with him.
Oh, and had traveled with him from lifetime
to
lifetime.
Had never reincarnated and had just always traveled with him waiting for revenge. And so his revenge would take the form of an illness or a sickness.
Oh, yes.
And there was another one with a priest who had some kind of, or it was a guy that had a problem with his throat. And it was traced back to a past life where he was he betrayed a friend. He was a priest and he betrayed someone. But instead of reincarnating, this person he betrayed became like this noose in another dimension.
Oh, how weird.
And was like in another dimension. He was just constantly choking this guy because he wanted revenge for this life eons ago that was some kind of injustice.
So the problem with that kind of stuff is, though, how do you deal with that? Because in these regressions, it's like it's always the person. So the person has been responsible for it so they can clear it. But if you've got someone else's hatred, like do you atone for it?
I think it was resolved through communication with the entity.
Ah, but see how that fits in with this category as well? Is because is it really another entity, or is it that it's something that's been created in that person's mind, which manifests in this way?
Well, why would you create in your mind that you killed a rival Mongol warrior in the 15th century?
But that's the thing. But in light of, you know, the psychological, and this is definitely what Mule and Moody wanted to focus on, is they don't really go into the paranormal. They cross more into this being some type of, you know, a very unusual psychological mechanism, which I don't necessarily...
It's just all too easy to say things are created by the psyche. It's all too easy to say that it's some kind of, some kind of creation from our minds.
I think so too, in light of...
It's like any paranormal topic, you can say that. It's just a creation of the mind. Why?
I think it's a really good example that, we talk about the creation of tulpas. Like, if those things are real, which they appear to be from the stories, then it wouldn't be that different in the mind. Like, it really wouldn't be. But then there's a couple of other cases I just want to mention for you. One is writer's block, and I thought this was intriguing. There was a guy that was suffering from writer's block. He could not, no matter what he did, he'd always get close to the finishing a book, and he couldn't finish writing it. He couldn't. He'd just be like, oh, I can't do this. He sought out therapy. He goes and has regression therapy, and he finds himself sitting in this crappy little decrepit flat that he's broke. And guess what he is in this lifetime? A writer. And so the regression hypnotist is like, well, skip forward 5 years. And he's just like, opened up this letter where he's like, your work is garbage. We're not publishing you, right? And she's like, oh. And he's like, oh. And she's like, oh, skip forward 5 years. And he's like, oh. Another letter. We're not publishing your work. You're crap. And he's like, oh. And this guy ultimately he ends up working in a library. She's like, skip forward to where, you're at the end of your life. He's working in a library. And he's like, putting all these books back. He's all like, all these books and none of them has my name on it. And then he dies.
Stop being a fucking failure. Stop being a loser.
That's what the regressionist essentially did. But it was because he had developed in this previous life this constant fear of failure from being rejected so long.
Let it go.
For whatever reason, this lifetime he was being an author again or a writer. Every time he almost got to the end, he sabotaged himself. So, could it be that he really was having all these failures in a previous life, or did he just generate this? Is this some type of psychological issue that he's having, which is generating this whole thing behind it? I don't know. The last one, though, from Moody's work I thought was intriguing. It's called Regression Road Rage. And I thought this was pretty good. So this was the guy, his name was Jeff, and Jeff apparently was an all-round good guy. Really, really nice.
Love Jeff.
Love Jeff.
You know, great guy.
He was never prone to any type of anger issues, anything like that, except for when he was driving. And when he would drive, he would have horrific road rage, and he would have panic attacks, anxiety. He'd be freaking out. He'd be so volatile and so angry that people wouldn't want to drive with him. So he sought therapy. Like, he sought out therapy, and they dug through everything. They couldn't find any reason why this normally mellow, very kind man turned into this kind of Jekyll and Hyde monster when he was behind the wheel. So he undergoes regression hypnosis. He finds himself as a German soldier in the Libyan desert in a tank that's just been blown up.
Oh, my God.
And he's a tank driver, and he can't get out. And there's a second shelling that starts coming through, and when this second shelling comes through, he's trapped inside it. And he's killed, obviously. And he's so angry because he's got time to try and get out, and he's trying to get out, and he dies before he can get out. That somehow carried through into this lifetime. But where this becomes a little bit more unusual is that the psychotherapist that was treating him tried to use a technique which was known as reassignment, right? And what this is that you get the person to play out the scene of what happened, and then you get them to imagine something else. Like, oh, no, you actually get out of the tank and you run away and you kind of jump as everything bursts into flames. Didn't work. Like, it didn't work. No, and apparently it has worked in other methodologies. But for whatever reason, he kept on having this rage. So that was like, no, you have to go through it. And he did. He realized that this was something that he had to, and now he understood it, and something that he had to experience, the road rage abated by itself. But it was like, it was built into his psyche of who he is.
Right.
It's kind of like a karmic kind of thing that he had to go through that, and he couldn't erase it. Because if he erased it, it didn't stop the problem that was occurring with him. So those books I'll link to in the show notes at mysteriousuniverse.org so you can check it out. But I want to go into the idea of ancestral memories. This is the zone 3 kind of stuff. And, you know, where I've gone, there's a piece that was published back in the 1960s by Armand Gollet. Now, Armand Gollet describes the idea of ancestral memories in dreams. And the way that he got there was essentially, he claimed for 30 years, from the time he was about 12 years old, he had the same dream 4 to 5 times a year, like just constant. Like it was just, and he said it was incredible. Like he'd always find himself standing before this white provincial French home, and he could describe its details. He said there were, you know, dormers on the roof. I'm not exactly sure what dormers are, but they're important to the story, so I'll include them. there were these dormers on the roof, and there was these bright potted plants that were lining the windowsills. And he kind of got an idea that he knew where it was, but he could describe everything. And I guess after you have this repeated dream 4 to 5 times a year for 30 years, you would be able to remember it. And it would change perspectives as well. Sometimes he'd be standing on the balustrade. Sometimes he'd be able to walk up steps. But what was weird for him is that whenever he tried to go up to a certain level, he found himself being hit by this invisible goopy kind of goo wall. Like in this dream, like he could never push through, and he'd try to push and the pressure would get stronger and stronger, and it becomes so firm that it would reject him and actually push him backwards and like boing as he comes back from this wall. And this went on and on and on for so long until he started talking about it. Like he was just saying, oh, there's kind of, it's weird that I'm imagining this space. And he somehow got an understanding that, again, the synchronicity that happens, a family member out of the blue sends him this book that they'd written, right? And this book that this family member had written was actually, it had their entire family history. So you know how people, you know, usually older people now get involved with their ancestry. Well, they'd written this whole book on the ancestry of the family. And Armand opens up the package to look at this book. There's this photograph on the front page. And the photograph on the front page is his dream. Like it's the same house that's in his dream. And it's not like it's like,
With
the dormer. And he's just in shock. He's like, oh my God, this is the place. It turns out it's from Switzerland.
That's a dormer.
Oh, there you go.
The
right.
Dormer so is like a window.
Like a little window box
that
kind of thing.
Comes out of the roof.
Right. So he sees this and he immediately calls up his family member. He's like, where's this from? Where's this from? And he's like, oh, well, I found it through searching for our ancestry. And here's the details. And it's this chateau that's in Switzerland. And he's like, I have to go. Like after having dreams for so long, I have to go to this place. But it was a point in his life where he couldn't quite afford it. And it was a big journey. And it just so happens that he's telling this to his boss. Like he says to his boss, look at this. I've been having this dream for 30 years. And look, they sent me a photograph of it out of the blue. And his boss is like, oh, well, I haven't told you yet, but I'm actually going on a trip through Europe and we're going through Switzerland. So if you give me the address, I can go and check out the house for you and take some photos. And he's very appreciative. He's like, oh my God, that's really good. So his boss goes off on the journey and he comes home. The boss comes back with all these photographs and he's just enthralled because he's looking at these photos from all these different angles. And he's like, oh my God, like I know this, like this is definitely the place. And he's like, look, and the boss says, look, just to let you know, I actually went and knocked on the door and I went and spoke to the people that lived there. He's like, what? You did what? And he says, look, I went and spoke to them. There's only been one owner in 300 years, right? Or there've only been one change of owner in 300 years. This house is 300 years old.
Wow.
And it'd been up until only the people that were living there now had only been there for the past, you know, 20 or so years. And the boss tells them, the people living there, the story. And apparently their jaws drop, right? and they're in shock because what had happened was is Armand had written down in great detail like everything he'd had from these dreams. He'd never been there. There's no photographs of it online. We're talking about the 60s when this story came out. There's no way that he could have known this. But he described inside the house and he was kind of disappointed, Armand, because he was like, oh, you know, like inside this dream that he'd been having, he saw all these archways. There were all these archways all through the home and the dormers. And when he's looking at these photographs and they're talking to the people that live there now, there's no archways. It's like all square and there's no dormers on the roof. So Armand starts, you know, kind of going down the path of, well, is this just a weird dream that I've been having? Is this some weird quirk? Like what's, it just so happens, right, that on this particular house, the family members that had lived there previously were genetically related to Armand, right?
No way.
Genetically related to Armand. The new owners said, oh, and this is why their mouths dropped. About 20 years ago when they'd first moved in, they removed the dormers and they changed all the arches to squared throughout the house. No one knew except for the builders that had done that. And somehow he had pulled this from these dreams, but he was genetically related to the people that had lived there previously, implying that there is some type of zone 3 mule style genetic memory that's occurring here.
Yeah, this is research we've been covering on the show recently. Information travels through genetic connections.
Yeah. And I mean, again,
for good or for bad,
there's still this weird element of synchronicities that play a part here, though. So it's almost like I feel like yes, it could just be a natural phenomenon of genetic memory, but it also feels like there's this guiding hand somehow. There's something which is causing these coincidences to take place for these stories to come to the surface.
I mean, what was the result of him meeting that family again? Did he reunite with lost family? I mean,
it just gave him an incredible experience that he was able to tell people about, but it didn't change anything. Like
he was eating out on that story for years.
Yeah. I always say, always have two good stories when you're at a dinner party. And that was the one that he used for a long time.
Right.
So, but there's also research that was conducted by Margaret Ryder. And Margaret Ryder in the 70s conducted a whole heap of, research, regression, past life regressions.
Love Margie's work.
She did it into twins, right? She did all this research into twins. And, you know, I'll put some of her work in the show notes so you can check it out. But ultimately, you know, she got, in the 1970s, she got a bunch of twins together and she put them through regressions when they weren't in the same room. They weren't connected to each other.
Did her research ultimately prove that they're not real people and they don't have souls?
Well, no, they kind of like shared this weird idea that they were sharing the same like past life memories.
What?
Yeah, they were sharing the same past life memories. And she did crazy things. Like she got them to describe like in minute detail things that they were seeing. And so she sent them to specific times so she could get a comparison between the two. And they were almost identical every single time.
That's bizarre.
Like it's really, really weird, right? Except for there was a time that she did triplets, right? Yeah. So she got these triplets in. And when she got these triplets in, they were called, I'm going to just bring up their name for you here. This was the Hills triplets. This was Colleen, Carla, and Candace. And she spent several weeks working with them in the November of 1997. And the stories of all these three girls was essentially similar, except for one glaring deception, which she couldn't quite work out at first. But essentially, she sends them all through and she says, well, go to the morning of your 20th birthday. And they all describe this satin-like gown, something gold in their hair. One difference between two girls is that one said the gown was like a soft pink and the other one said it was like, oh, it was a pinkish white. So, you know, no real difference, yeah. Like only very subtle. But it wasn't until they were sent to another lifetime where they find themselves as Native Hawaiians. And they're Native Hawaiians, but it's only one person, right? But this one person experience ends up becoming triplets.
They all have memories of this one Polynesian lifetime.
Memories, except one of them, right, seemingly picks up that, so I think it was Colleen and Carla. So Colleen was like, oh, there's this man standing there and he's Caucasian and he's wearing a white suit. And then meanwhile, Carla is like, oh no, he's wearing traditional Hawaiian outfit and he's dark skinned. And they're like, what's going on here? It just so happens that Colleen recalled the preacher while Carla did recall the husband. But the strange thing was, is that they ended up having twins, right? There were these twin kids that were there of their previous life. So that was her as the bride. They skip forward for all three women in the regression. I know it's a little bit difficult to follow, but they skip forward, still looking at the life of that singular woman. And they find that she has twins, right? So she had twins. The conclusion that Marge comes to is that essentially Colleen had inherited the memory of one of those twins and Carla had inherited the memory of the other. And Candace, who was the third triplet, right?
Was the mother.
No, she had received a composite of the two memories.
What?
Like a recombinant memory. So when you looked at these three stories, the same from the three different angles,
yeah.
But it had been inherited differently and recombinant. And so this is where ultimately she's like, it's possible that when genes divide, as in the case of identical twins or triplets, the memory travels from generation to generation, such as a gene does, but it recombines in different fashions in different triplets. It's really out there. Like, it's really unusual out there.
That's
kind of stuff.
Up there with the Dick Sutphin idea that you can reincarnate twice at the same time.
That's right. Yeah. And Moody does touch on Dick Sutphin as well. Like, he goes into some of his, and you're right. Yeah. That you can have kind of like multiple existences at the same time because time is irrelevant. And I like that kind of idea. But ultimately, I want to give this a wider view because I like, you know, because I'm very much fascinated by the paranormal aspects of all this kind of stuff. And I certainly lean more to that direction that that's what's occurring. There's some type of entities going on. But I'm also intrigued by the possibility of it being some type of innate psychological mechanism that we all have. And if we investigate it further and dig further, perhaps we'll get a greater understanding because the potential benefits of this could outweigh any type of, you know, trying to go through taboos or ridicule or anything that could happen. Because if you can heal people by accessing supposed past life memories or secondary identities, imagine how that would revolutionize health and how it would change psychology. It would have massive societal, you know, repercussions in such a good fashion.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you do if you've got a crazy splintered off personality trapped inside you and you don't know what to do with it?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it could eliminate the need for the use of pharmaceutical psychotropic medications, those sorts of things. Yeah, obviously, Big Pharma would not be happy about that, and Big Museum probably wouldn't be either. But, you know, there's a whole range of attributes here that could be quite, have a potential great outcome for society. But also, I want to look at this from a wider perspective, so I want to go into also some traditional Chinese medicine.
Oh, you've got more?
So in the Plus extension, I want to talk to you about Lin Yun, the dream doctor, who will visit people in their dreams and read their qi and give them info as to what is going on with their health. But on top of that as well, he can even access past lives to work out where your energy has traveled. He can see the path of your qi energy and what it's moved through to create your problems in this life.
You're telling me there's a doctor who can just come and solve my problems literally while I'm asleep.
Literally while you're asleep.
I don't have to line up. Nope. I don't have to go to the practice. Nope. I don't have to do anything like that.
And you don't even need to ask for help. He'll just come to you.
He just comes.
He'll just appear to you.
This guy sounds expensive.
Well, I'm sure he is. He is revered, apparently, in these circles that follow him. So this is, again, from the 1960s. But we'll go into that in our Plus extension coming up right after this.
We're also going to discover in the Plus extension if dinosaurs are, in fact, the greatest hoax of all time and if Big Museum is to blame. Sign up today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. You get the big extensions we do on every single one of these shows. And of course, you get an exclusive show that comes out on Tuesdays. You're getting more than double the content when you sign up for Plus. mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Check it out today. $9 a month. Help support your favorite show. You also get a higher quality version of the show in terms of audio. You get an ad-free version of the show as well. And if you sign up for MU Max, you get access to our entire back catalog as well. Again, help support your favorite show, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free edition of the show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Extension, great to have you with us. Let's hear about this.